call this meeting of the Judiciary Committee to order. Members, take your seats. Chair recognizes the quorum. Members, today we have two bills up. Representative Stevenson has his House File 15, Voluntary Relationship Defense. And then Representative Scott has House File 54 up, which we'll get an update on that. Can I have a motion to approve the minutes for February 5th? Representative Cantrell moves the minutes of February 5th. Any discussion? All in favor of the minutes as presented, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Minutes of February 5th are approved. Representative Stevenson, I just saw you. Oh, there you are. Come on down, and members will be considering House File 15. This was heard in Public Safety Committee, and it's here because of the voluntary relationship defense component for judiciary. So I'll move that Representative Stevenson's bill, House File 15, be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And we have the bill before us. Representative Stevenson, welcome to the committee. There is an author's amendment labeled A2. Can I have a motion to put the bill in the form that the author wants?
Representative Johnson and I were having a discussion about that amendment today, and we'd like to talk a little bit more about it. Instead,
okay.
The author's amendment contains two provisions, one that actually is also in Representative Johnson's amendment, which is uncontroversial, and then the second provision that we'd like more time to talk about after the fact. So I would, if the committee is willing, I would ask the committee to adopt Representative Johnson's amendment and not the author's amendment at this time.
Okay, so Representative Stevenson, these are two amendments. This is not one amendment that you suggest is divisible. It's two separate amendments. Is that right?
That's correct. There's an amendment before the committee that I put forward that's an author's amendment that contains a few different edits to the bill, one of which is Representative Johnson's separate amendment. And all the other edits, Representative Johnson, I need some more time to talk about. And so I'm just asking the committee today to adopt just Representative Johnson's amendment.
Chair Johnson's is the A1. So we're looking at the A1. Is that
yes.
right? Okay. All in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Representative Stevenson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Importantly, this is the first time that I have appeared before this committee. Some treats are circulating. I want to take care of the important business first. I also want to alert the committee and also people who are watching in the gallery that this bill relates to a very difficult subject, and the testimony that I will give, as well as the testimony that the witness will give, is direct and graphic, and people should be prepared for that. It's certainly not suitable for all ages. And so with that, I will begin. Members of the committee, under existing Minnesota law, if a man drugs his wife and rapes her while she is unconscious, he cannot be prosecuted for rape. We like to think of so-called marital rape exceptions as an artifact of history, relics from a time when a woman was considered the property of her husband. But we still have a limited marital rape exception on the books today, and the bill before you would repeal that limited marital rape exception. This bill passed last year. It was included in the omnibus prime bill. It has passed the Senate relevant Senate committee in a larger bill a couple weeks ago. The bill is also supported by MnCASA and the County Attorneys Association. Members, you may think that this is just an academic exercise. It's not. I'm here to tell you that it happens. There's a fiscal note in your packets updated for this year, and if you read the analysis attached to the fiscal note, you'll see that the Sentencing Guideline Commission estimates that repeal of this provision, particularly as it relates to the mentally impaired, mentally incapacitated, or physically helpless provision, will result in 7 additional convictions each year. That's 7 people who are denied justice as a result of this provision. I also want to note a recent Court of Appeals decision, State v. Goswich, which was decided on December 31st of 2018. In that case, a man had sex on multiple dates with a woman who, and I'm quoting from the decision, according to the psychological assessments, functions at the mental capacity of a 7- or 8-year-old child. He was charged by the Brown County Attorney, but 6 weeks before trial, the defendant married the victim. The trial court dismissed the case, referring to this statute. Fortunately, the Court of Appeals reversed, citing in part the possibility that interpreting the voluntary relationship defense as applying to marriages occurring after the fact would, quote, permit or even encourage an actor to marry in order to avoid culpability for criminal conduct re-victimizing the victim. I think the Court of Appeals was wise to think of the unintended consequences of this statute as applied to after-the-fact marriages, but we should think seriously about the unintended consequences that are already in play by this statute. I also want to point out that that Court of Appeals decision was 2-1, meaning that we were one judge away from that statute being used to dismiss that case. But you don't have to take my word for it or the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Or concern yourself with the what-if at play in State v. Goswich. In just a couple minutes, you're going to hear from Jenny Thiessen, who's seated to my right, who lived this nightmare herself. Just as an aside, again, the author's amendment, which is adopted, the only change in it, or it's actually Representative Johnson's amendment that he suggested in the Public Safety Committee last week, is moving the effective date up to the date following enactment. It had previously been July 1st. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can recall learning in law school about the 17th century English common law principle that a husband could never be convicted of raping his wife because by consenting to marry, quote, the wife hath given herself up to her husband. I'm sure that all of us find those words repugnant, and it's time for our laws to match our values. So thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and with the chair's permission, I'll turn it over to Jenny Thiessen.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. Ms. Thiessen, please introduce yourself to the committee.
Good morning. My name is Jenny Hager, soon to be Thiessen. Divorce is almost final. Thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you for hearing House File 15 today and my personal testimony. My name is Jenny Thiessen, soon to be Thiessen, and I feel grateful to be able to address you and the committee today. Last year when this bill was before a committee, actually in this same room, I was sitting in the room listening to this bill being brought forward. However, I was unable to testify because criminal charges were still pending on my former spouse regarding his actions. Since then, he has publicly admitted that he drugged me, he raped me, and he videotaped it in our Andover home. In March 2016, I discovered a flash drive containing several videos of my former spouse recording his coworkers in the private staff bathroom at his place of employment, and two videos of me in our home that I was unaware of. 2 months after serving my husband divorce papers and preparing my affidavit for divorce, I was tasked with reviewing every photo and video from a copy of our home laptop computer. I came across two videos that forever changed my life. The videos were of my husband recording me on New Year's morning 2016. The first video starts out with a screenshot of my vagina. My former spouse is forcefully inserting a synthetic penis in and out of my vagina for several seconds while my body lay lifeless. He pauses the forceful penetration, and he carefully crawls through the covers to reveal my face. My mouth is wide open, and it is clear that I am unconscious. He starts to move the camera back down to my lower body when the video reveals our 4-year-old son is laying next to me in bed. He came back 1 hour later to do the same act again, starting and recording for a second time. He put not only my life in danger, but was potentially exposing our son to something unthinkable. The worst part of that day was my mom was at the house when I discovered the rape videos. My mom and I sat and cried for hours as I discovered I had been drugged and raped by my husband. No parent should ever have to experience their daughter in complete and utter pain, deception, confusion, disbelief, no one. Immediately after discovering these videos, I called the Anoka County Sheriff Detective, who was the main point of contact in my active criminal investigation regarding my former spouse. I was informed that someone would follow up with me soon to take my statement. Sadly, that was not the case. It took me over 2 months of me calling the sheriffs and talking to many different people before I was scheduled to come in and give my statement. In September 2017, I received a call from a victim witness specialist with the Anoka County Attorney's Office. She called to inform me that my former spouse had been formally charged with one count felony criminal sexual conduct in the third degree. To be honest, I had mixed emotions about this news. The strongest emotion I was feeling was a sense of safety, not only for myself, but I have two very young children and also our community. Knowing that justice was going to be served. Later that afternoon, just as I was headed to get my kids from the school bus, I received another call from the Anoka County Victim Witness Specialist. She called to inform me that she had some news and she was at a loss for words. She explained that she wasn't sure how to tell me the news, but it was life-changing. She explained that my former spouse's felony third-degree criminal sexual charges were dropped because his criminal defense attorney made them aware at the county attorney's office that there's a law on the Minnesota books that states a person cannot be charged with a crime if they are married at the time of the crime. She said the entire staff in the attorney's office did not know this law existed. The judge didn't know the law existed. And they were all in shock, and they said to me, the victim witness said, this needs to be changed. I was absolutely devastated and scared that night. I struggled with the news. I got my kids off the bus, sucked it up, watched some Harry Potter with them, and her words stuck in my head. She said, this needs to be changed. And by the next morning, I was ready to go to work. I was on Google searching everything possible, and I was ready to go to work to make sure that no one in a similar situation hears, I'm sorry, the charges have been dropped. The county was able to charge fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct and invasion of privacy, which was finally sentenced in December of 2018, my former spouse pled guilty to invasion of privacy in home. What he did to me was sexual assault, yet nothing on his record shows the crimes that he committed against me. In an excerpt from the sentencing transcript of our court file, Anoka County prosecuting attorney Paul Young is quoted by saying, "This court knows the psychological evaluations that were done and the recommendations find him to be moderate to high risk to reoffend. While we see other offenders with that, it is concerning given that before even reaching these conclusions, this is a person that has had sex offender counseling, therapy, marriage counseling, and is still at the stage after all this time a high risk to the community. Since felony charges were dropped because we were married, not only myself, but our communities are being put at risk from sexual predators like my former spouse." In closing, I'd like to read an excerpt from my victim impact statement that I read in the sentencing hearing for invasion of privacy. In September 2017, Matt was charged with third-degree criminal sexual assault, and those charges were dropped because in the state of Minnesota, if you are married, you cannot be charged with sexual assault degrees 1 through 4, even if your spouse is incapacitated when the sexual assault takes place. And today, he has entered a plea of 45 days jail and invasion of privacy. At a minimum, he should have to register as a sex offender. More jail time is also warranted. The Star Tribune recently ran a series titled Deny Justice that examines how Minnesota's criminal justice system often fails victims of rape and sexual assault. With a plea agreement that was reached, this becomes one more story of a victim that has been failed. I would rather be in the victim heard, justice served category. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Seeger. Members, before I take questions, if there are questions for the author or Ms. Seeger, I would state that, you know, I think Ms. Seeger knows it's difficult for folks to hear the testimony. It has a substantial impact on everyone in the room, and we appreciate your willingness to come forward and tell your story, because even though it's difficult for people to hear, this committee is a policymaking committee and absolutely needs to hear this. So I appreciate Representative Stevenson's trigger warning on this, but I think this is a pivotal and critical part of what we do here, especially for the first-term members of this committee. So thank you with that. Are there questions for the author or Ms. Seeger? Representative Mullen.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Thiessen, I just wanted to thank you so much for coming here today. I'm on the Public Safety Committee, too, and heard your testimony then. And I want to commend you for your courage, not only to share your story, but to make change for all the other survivors who aren't getting justice. And we just really do appreciate you coming here, and I'm so sorry that he did that to you. I'm sorry that justice wasn't served, and I'm hopeful that we can make a difference for other survivors like you, but we can't do it without your voices. And so we really, really truly do appreciate it, and thank you also to Representative Stevenson for bringing this bill forward. Thank you.
Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, Representative Stevenson, to the testifier Jenny Hagan, soon to be testifier.
We'll just say Thiessen.
Thiessen. That's going to be a much better name for
it you. It is.
I also heard this in public safety, and I heard not your story, but a different story, similar issue last year in the Public Safety Committee. And in my career in law enforcement, my goal was to never have to have a victim testify in court. Because not only were you a victim when it occurred, you were a victim when you had to tell law enforcement what happened. You were a victim when you had to prepare and testify in court. And now you've been a victim twice here, and I want to thank you for being able to do that. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of courage and a lot of strength. And this is something that, as Representative Stevens had said, it was in the bill last year that was vetoed, unfortunately. But this is something we need to do, and we need to do it now.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Jenny, thanks for being here. And I can't say that if I was in the same situation that I'd be brave enough to be here and tell this committee what you just told us. And so for that, I'm thankful. And you have a lot to be proud of. Your kids have a really strong mom. And I know at least your dad, I don't think I've ever met your mom, but I know that they've been a great support for you. And I'm so proud of you. And I just thank you for being brave so that other women hopefully won't have to be in that same situation and come here after it's happened to somebody else. So I wish you the best, and you know where to find me if you need me. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Hassan.
Good morning, everyone, Mr. Chair and our representative. I want to thank Ms. Is it Thiessen?
Yeah.
I want to commend you for your courage. I am sorry that this happened to you, but I am very, very proud of what you're doing with it, that you chose not to be a victim, but rather to be an advocate for many women. I am sure a lot of people are watching this and are triggered by this because it happened to them and they didn't have the support or the courage or the bravery to come forward and fight for this. So I commend you. This is the second time I'm hearing your story. I was at the other hearing, was it public safety? And it's painful to listen to your story, but I am hopeful that this law that we're trying to change is going to benefit many, many women. Thank you.
Well, Representative Grossman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to serve on the Public Safety Board, and thank you for coming forward in this committee. You know, I've listened to these things, and I've got legislation. You're concerned about your former husband, your former spouse, still being out in the community, having received such a plea deal that it's It's absurd that they should receive plea deals like that and not be kept good track of. And trying to get these bills to move forward, and it's a battle, but it's one that I'm going to keep fighting to make sure that victims like you, victims like there's so many, that they're not being heard, the justice not being served to them, and it's on something called it's better to get something than nothing. So it's some of the legislation I have. I'm hoping to keep it moving forward to represent our victims better. And thank you for bringing this bill forward, sir.
Russell, any other members' questions? Okay. So there's no other amendments. Are there any further discussion on the bill? Then the motion is that it be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means with the recommendation that it be placed on the general register. This is House File 15 as amended. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Congratulations. Again, thank you for your testimony. Ms. Thiessen, thank you for bringing this bill. Representative Stevenson, and you're on your way to Ways and Means. Members, the next bill we have up is Chair Scott's House File 54. Members, this bill was laid over last week to give the author a chance to talk to some stakeholders and decide whether or not she wanted to offer an amendment. So Representative Scott moves her bill to get it before the committee. The motion is that it be placed on the general register or be laid over for possible inclusion in the data practices omnibus bill. We have this before us, and Chair Scott, it's the chair's intention that it be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Is our intent.
All right.
Tell us about the bill.
Chair Lesh, I'm just wondering if we could bring up and hear from Mr. Busey. He was not able to be here at the original hearing, and so he was the one that kind of brought this issue to my attention. And so, if it's okay with the chair, I would love for him to take just a couple minutes and tell why he sees the need for the bill, and then I can go on with comments.
Sure. Please have him come up. Please introduce yourself for the committee and your testimony.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Christopher Busey. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for the Minnesota Legislative Auditor's Office. I oversee the Financial Audit Division of the Legislative Auditor. Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm here today to show support for the proposed changes to Minnesota's government data breach statute 13.055. From my years, I joined the OLA about a year ago, and I spent about 11 years as the state's chief information security officer, and I had an opportunity to deal with lots of data breach situations over the years. And despite the fact that we have lots of issues that happen in the news every day, I can tell you from firsthand experience that citizens still care deeply about the privacy of their data. And this proposed change to Minnesota law helps ensure government transparency, or to put the issue a different way, it changes our statute so that if a government entity exposes data, they must notify the subjects of that data. For those of you that aren't familiar with the government data breach statute, the statute defines what needs to happen when a breach occurs, but the issue at hand is really providing clarity on what constitutes a breach. And today the law has two litmus tests. The first one is intuitive. There has to be unauthorized access to not public data. The second litmus test, though, is that along with that access to not public data, there has to be the intent of the person to use that data for non-governmental purpose. And it's that second litmus test which is really problematic. One of the things that I found over the years when dealing with these kind of incidents is that most of the data security incidents, and particularly those that result in breaches, aren't caused by hackers today. Most of those incidents are caused by employee mistakes. People that get unauthorized access to data as a result of these employee mistakes never intend to use the data. for unauthorized purposes. It just happens to land in their hands because some other employee made a mistake. So consequently, under the law today, almost every one of these situations can be explained away as an accidental exposure and not a breach because it doesn't meet the second litmus test in the law. The proposed change eliminates the second litmus test, and it moves the state into a world where all unauthorized exposures of not public data will be notified to the subjects of the data. It simplifies our law. It brings it in line with the statute of notification to the legislative auditor's office as well. I've had an opportunity to chat with many government agencies about this language change over the last couple weeks. And government agencies certainly have some concerns about the change. There's concerns that this will result in notification for breaches that are truly not risky. I also heard concerns about there's going to be more notification for breaches that occur within or between government agencies. And one of the things I've told these individuals that have spoken to me from different organizations is that I'm not the deciding factor here. It's like it's all of you on this committee that have to balance that need for transparency in data breaches with all the different situations that occur to kind of figure out what is going to be the right bar that you think is appropriate for the citizens of our state. Mr. Chair and committee members, that was the end of my testimony today. I'd certainly be willing to take any questions. I kind of feel a little flustered after that last bill. It took my breath away.
Thank you, Mr. Boosie. Questions for Mr. Boosie from members. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Boosie, question for you. In your testimony, you referenced the mistakes made, where I think you, the words you used were that data just landed in an employee's hands. Can you give an example to where that would give us an example of how that would play out?
Okay. Mr. Chair, committee members, there's so many different scenarios that happen like this. There's examples where IT employees may make a mistake as they're changing a firewall rule that protects a system, and suddenly not public data is exposed and it shows up in somebody's hands. I've had situations where different computer applications, IT professionals make a change to the computer system, and suddenly people that use the system end up seeing other people's not public data. There's lots of very simple cases as well where employees have not public data in spreadsheets, and they end up sending it out to a whole list of individuals that were never supposed to get that data. The number of scenarios that I've encountered over the years, I could go on and on and on with the types of scenarios that happen where there's just simple mistakes.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chair, follow-up. So how is that then dealt with?
Mr. Boosie.
Mr. Chair, committee members, when I was the state's chief information security officer, what we did with all of these scenarios is we had a computer forensic team that worked on those. And one of the things that we wanted to do is, first of all, if there was an ongoing issue where data was exposed, first of all, we tried to quarantine the damage and prevent further spreading of the damage. So we went through a phase typically where we did quarantine of the situation. And then we moved into an investigation phase where we tried to figure out exactly what happened, what was the root cause that led to the problem. And then finally, we would always make an effort to try and look at, is there forensic evidence available for us to prove whether or not data ended up in the wrong hands? If data did not end up in the wrong hands, that we could prove it conclusively, we gave that information over to the agencies that we served as MINUTE. If we could not conclude conclusively that we couldn't determine whether something happened, we let the agencies know. But generally, we did the forensic work, and we turned it over to the agencies. If we felt like data was disclosed inappropriately or we couldn't tell, we generally told the agencies that we can't tell what happened here. We gave them the forensic report, and we'd say that, you know, we think that you have to go ahead and notify the OLA under Minnesota state law. And at that time, before really fully understanding the nuance of this law, I would generally recommend that you probably should consider going through with data breach notification. But that decision was the agency's decision because they are the owners of the data.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Chair Lash. Mr. Boosie, just one last follow-up. So this this risk analysis that we heard testimony of from some of the agency directors before is pretty robust. It sounds like there's a process which takes place to where that leads to a report that's brought to the director's attention, to which they make a final decision. The process seems to be well defined.
Is that a question, Representative Carlson, or statement?
I'll frame that as a question. Mr. Boosie, would you say that the process is well-defined in terms of the forensic work being done as far as the risk analysis?
Mr. Boosie.
Mr. Chair, committee members, without actually seeing the kind of forensic process that organizations go through, I can't make a call on something that I've never seen, I've never examined. Forensics is complicated. And risk is truly in the eyes of the beholder. That's one of the things that we really have to consider here. So the question that you'll have to wrestle with as policymakers is, do you feel comfortable giving the discretion over to agencies to make that risk-based decision?
Thank you, Mr. Boosie.
Okay. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to further, because I think there's maybe some wires getting crossed, because Mr. Boosie and his previous employment, that's what he did. I mean, when they believed that there was some sort of a breach, then they did the forensics. But we're talking, if there's an agency right now and they inadvertently sent some not public data from one agency to another agency, right now, if they think that the intent was not there if they don't think the intent on the part of the receiver would be to use that for an unauthorized purpose, then they don't have to disclose that to the people or people's information that were breached. So right now the law says if there's no intent on the person receiving, then we don't have to notify. But what Mr. Boosie was saying too is that they tried to err on the side of caution, encourage these agencies to go ahead and contact people, but at the end of the day, it was up to the agency. And you have to understand that these breaches and stuff, they're embarrassing, you know, but they happen commonly in our data-driven world, and so I think it's really important that we have a crystal-clear law that says this is what you need to do in those cases.
And Representative Carlson, I expect that some folks are going to come and testify on this, too, so... Let's. If you all have questions, or either rhetorical questions or critical questions, maybe we can wait until they testify. It might clarify some things. But did you still have a question, Representative Hassan?
No.
Okay.
I'll wait.
Chair Johnson?
I do have a question for the testifier.
Okay, go ahead.
Chair Lash, the testifier. Just wondering how, if you had a rough idea how many times or a rough guess that you've made the recommendation to notify, and one of the agencies has not?
Mr. Boosie.
Madam Chair, committee members, no, I don't. And the reason why is because when we handed off the results of forensic work that we did and we turned it over to the agencies, we didn't follow up at that point to generally see how they followed through with that. So I don't have a number to give you or even a percent of how many times our recommendation was followed.
Okay. Thank you. We've got other testifiers here, I guess, right, who want to say no. What? Did I say? Okay. All right.
Give this one.
Okay, good. Won't be the last time. Why don't you come up and testify then? Oh, okay, Chris, we've got Kristen Anderson, Minnesota Management and Budget. Please introduce yourself to the committee and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kristen Anderson. I am General Counsel at Minnesota Management and Budget, and thank you for letting me address the committee here today. As you all know, the Data Practices Act is a really complex law and has so many moving parts that it seems like every time we change one piece of it, there's always a risk that it sets other things in motion. We do understand and appreciate the concerns that motivated House File 54. In particular, I did read Mr. Webster's memo regarding the situation in which he was sent data, apparently inadvertently. He is a member of the public, not within within government, and the institution didn't determine that that was a data breach, despite the fact that the information went out to a third party. And we understand how the current language about non-governmental purposes makes that situation a difficult situation. And we are committed to trying to address those concerns. However, we do think that the bill will have some unintended consequences, particularly around good faith disclosures within state government. At your request, Mr. Chair, we have met twice now with Representative Scott regarding our concerns, and we really do appreciate Representative Scott's time and willingness to listen. We've had some very good conversations. We are very motivated and will continue to work with the author to refine the language and ensure that we have the best bill possible.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Questions for Ms. Anderson? And thank you. Thank you. Oh.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Ms. Anderson, I'm just wondering, I know that the Data Practices Act is very complicated, and is there any concern that information that a county or agency is trying to grapple with, whether or not it should be disclosed under the Act, that they're going to err on the side of not disclosing something that should be for fear that there's going to, it's going to later be considered a breach, then that they would have to give notice to additional folks for?
Ms. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, I'm just wondering if there's something that an organization is trying to figure out if they do need to disclose it under the Data Practices Act and might err on the side of not disclosing something that should be just because they're afraid then that if they disclose this information and it turns out later to not be something that they should have disclosed, that they have a breach they have to deal with.
Ms. Anderson.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Mueller, I can only speak to the processes that we use. I mean, we take data breaches seriously, and if there is disclosure to outside third parties, you know, we actually are also subject to HIPAA, and so we were sort of programmed to make those disclosures, and we're very careful about how we disclose. We don't disclose private data in doing the disclosure. So when a third party gets that data, we notify the individual whose data it is. We give enough information to identify what happened, what types of data of theirs was breached, what they might need to do in response. But we're very careful to make sure that we're not disclosing the identity of the breacher so that we don't create additional data breach concerns, if that answers your question.
Yeah, I'm trying to think more on the front end of it. If there's just, and I think maybe Representative Scott, you were kind of nodding when I was asking if you maybe had an answer to that question, or
so I think.
Here, Scott.
If I understand correctly, you're asking, are you asking what methodologies they use before they? Okay, I see what you're saying. You're wanting to know if an agency is ever fearful that if they disclose something that they maybe don't absolutely have to disclose, that later that might cause harm. That you're wondering what if that motivates them when they make the decision whether or not to disclose.
Right. Representative Mueller.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Because there's so many gray areas with data practice, that's my concern, is that then information isn't going to get disclosed initially that should be, because there'll be this concern later on that it might be a breach.
Jessica.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Mueller. I mean, I can't speak for the agencies, but I think that is something that they probably do take into account. they'd have to answer those questions, but I see where you're going with it.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Anderson.
Thank you.
Christy Lottie Johnson. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Christy Lottie Johnson, and I am the responsible authority and data compliance official for Hennepin County. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you here today. As at the committee meeting last week, you encouraged us to meet with the author to discuss our concerns that we had regarding the proposed change to remove the intent language. We really appreciate that Representative Scott met with us twice and heard us out, as well as you, Chair Lash, taking time to meet with us. The proposed language is not something that we would disagree with, and we believe that this amendment could be made more workable by responsibly notifying subjects when there's a risk of harm. However, given the timing, what we are doing is we are looking at working with others, and we plan to come forward with our own bill, and we will be contacting the members of the committee about this.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Lottie Johnson? Seeing none, then thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Okay. So any members of the public or anyone not on the list who wishes to be heard on this bill before we take action on it? Going once, going twice. Okay. Any other comments, concerns from members of the committee on this bill? House File 54.
Chair Lash?
Yes. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Chair Lash. Just a quick comment. Having been on the receiving end where having had not only personal information but credit card information handed over to a third party, this is an important issue to me as well as far as from a personal standpoint. But again, I see where the agencies are coming from in just the broadness of this and some of these kind of unintended consequences. Having served on this committee now for the past 2 years, I can see the complexities within Chapter 13. So I'm hopeful that a more workable solution can be brought forward that can kind of meet in the middle with this. But as of right now, I can't support the bill just based on just that the broad approach, despite my own desires to see something change for the better to protect individuals.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Comments from other members of the committee? I would just note that, members, we continue to see bills like this. The unintended consequences that Representative Carlson spoke of cut both ways. So when an agency or any entity decides, hey, it's a really good idea to collect data because look at all the good stuff we can do with the data and the metadata, they're not considering that is public. And that data then can be breached, putting those folks' personal information at risk as well. And over the course of the last 16 years since I've sat in this body, a lot of people, agencies have come forward saying, well, we're going to collect all this data, or maybe they didn't even come forward and ask us about it. And then we see the downstream effects and implications when, oh, wow, we've got all this data and could be breached. So I think it needs to be thought of, the downstream, secondary, and tertiary effects need to be thought of more across the board, and I think agencies are starting to consider that a little bit more. But with that, and seeing no other, Chair Scott.
Yeah, I just want to urge members to put yourself in the place of someone whose data has been breached, and would you want to know, regardless of what, if it was from one government agency to another, from one employee of a government agency to another, would you want to know? And I certainly would. Trust but verify. Not everyone that gets your data, in an unintended fashion is trustworthy. And so I think it's always best to err on the side of caution. And I'm certainly willing to talk to these folks more. But at the end of the day, I don't think we need to put it in the hands of the government agencies themselves to do a risk assessment. I think the law should be clear, so because really that's what we have right now with the intent piece, is it's subjective, and any risk assessment would be as well. So, with that, Mr. Chair, I'll hand it back to you.
Thank you, Chair Scott. With seeing no other comments, then The chair lays over House File 54 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Data Practices Bill. Okay. Oh, I guess I've got to do that, the magical tap, right? Okay. So tomorrow, February 7th, we will be hearing one bill. It's the only agenda item, so we should be able to finish the hearing and vote tomorrow during committee time. So there may be a lot of testimony on this bill, but I can tell members it's not my intent to bring you back at night to hear this, because we're taking an hour and a half, which is more than we take for almost any other bill. We dedicated an entire hearing to that, and so we will be completing this bill in an hour and a half. And so keep that in mind when we have discussion, that I might be a little more curt than as usual regarding comments, testimony, or questions, just so we can get through all the testifiers. And that is Representative Moeller's bill, House File 10, clarifying the definition of sexual harassment. This is the Joyce Pepin bill from last year. There being no other business before the committee. Oh, yep, Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some clarification about how the committee is going to play out tomorrow. And are you going to limit testimony to a certain amount of time? Will there be equal time for?
So we have, I think, as I recall, four listed testifiers in favor, or five in favor, four against, or something.
Now we have four.
It's like there's like four and four on the list. Okay. So what I thought I'd do is have those four and four and have them be, you know, succinct, but, you know, direct, as long as they don't drone on. And then we'll open it up. And I'm not going to limit it to pro and cons after those first four.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Okay. There being no other business before the committee is adjourned.